During the days of King Ahab, the priests of Baal became increasingly popular in Israel. Many had been imported into the land by the princess Jezebel, a Phoenician princess who had been married to the Israelite king. The Israelites were impressed by the colorful ceremonial of the Baali, the priests of Baal, and by the claimed potency of their healing and of their magic. Many felt that they could combine, that they could be ecumenical, they could combine at the attraction and attendance at the rites of the priests of Baal with the rites, the temple of God. Finally, one day, the majestic, towering figure of the prophet Elijah appears and challenges the people. How long will you halt between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. If Baal be God, follow him. The Bible tells us that the people were nonplussed. They remained silent, not a word was spoken. Until finally Elijah managed a very dramatic show of God's power on Mount Carmel, which according to the Bible proved the impotence, the powerlessness of the idolatrous cult, the power of faith in God. And then the people saw, the Bible tells us, and they were amazed and they said, Adonai hu ha-Elohim, the Lord he is God. Adonai hu ha-Elohim, the Lord he is God. An exultant declaration of faith, which you'll remember as the climactic formula of our liturgy on the Day of Atonement. As Neilah ends, three times we recite the same phrase, Adonai hu ha-Elohim, the Lord he is God. Now, during the last century, the priests and the prophets of radical politics and of radical economic analysis have become increasingly popular in our land, in many lands. And many have thought that they could combine with the worship of the one God, with the worship of the one ideology. Now, there was no Elijah to appear before them and to say, how long will you halt between two opinions? But their own conscience, their own mind made them wonder, how long can I halt between these two opinions? If Moses be the prophet of God, let me be a Jew. If Mark be the prophet of truth, then let me follow him. And there were many Jews who chose to follow the prophet and the leadership of the priests of political radicalism. For our people was a poor people, and it was a powerless people. Our people suffered all the indignity of the czars and of the kaisers and of the kings. We knew what it meant to be the underdog, not to have enough to feed our family, to live in powerlessness and degradation. And the prospect of an immediate overthrow, a successful revolution, was an enticing one. And our people had lived in the medieval world long after Western civilization had moved through the Renaissance and the Enlightenment into modern times. And many of our rites and our practices seemed archaic or useless or irrelevant to the new day. And it seemed to many that there was some truth to the radical analysis that religion was in fact not only a spiritual entity, but was in league with the repressive authorities, that religion did encourage people to be passive when they ought to be indignant, to accept the command, be patient so that you will qualify for the kingdom to come, when they ought to have accepted the command, be rebellious and be belligerent in order to achieve the kingdom of the dictatorship of the proletariat here on earth. And finally, And I suspect for many Jews, the most enticing of all the prospects that was offered to them was the idea that in this new world, all the old divisions between men, the divisions of nation and the divisions of race, would disappear. The only divisions which would have any meaning would be those of economic class. The Jew would simply be a comrade, one among the many of the proletariat, one among the workers, one among the makers of the new world. And all the old divisions of exclusiveness, all those, the stigma which had held onto him because he was Jew, these would disappear, and he would be a liberated, free, and equal citizen of a liberated, free, and economically just world. And so during the long past, many generations of the past century, many Jews have moved from the faith of Israel to the ideology of the socialist communist camp, and have felt that the best of the idealism of the prophets was somehow expressed in this new ideology, that they were not being untrue to the basic elemental stream of our tradition, but that in fact they had found a better way, a quicker way, to achieve the kingdom of God on earth. But most of all, they were motivated by the need to belong, to put behind them that which labeled, that which declared them to be separate. They wanted, as most Jews have wanted most desperately, simply to be human beings. Unfortunately, for those who made this choice, even in those countries where the socialist revolution succeeded in overthrowing the Tsar or the king or the noble class, it did not bring about this international, this open, this liberated world in which men would be seen as men. And though Jews, as many proletarians, came in large numbers to this ideological camp, they found that they alone, among those who joined up, they alone were singled out. They alone were declared to be social outcasts and put aside. In Eastern Europe, in Poland, in Russia, in the 1910s and 1920s, there was a Jewish Communist Party. Why was there a Jewish Communist Party? Because the Jews, in many cases, found that they could not be accepted and would not be accepted into the Russian socialist camp, into the Polish socialist or Polish communist party. Those who created the German Socialist Party in 1918 were in large number of Jews. The last time that the German Socialist Party was allowed to run for office in the Reichstag, 1931, not a single one of the over 400 candidates put up by the German Socialist Party was of Jewish extraction. They had all been pushed aside. They had all been purged. And we saw these purges against Jews in the Soviet Union in the 1930s under Stalin. We saw it again in the Soviet Union in the 1950s under Khrushchev, when people of Jewish extraction, those who had Hebraishek stamped on their passport, were purged from the foreign ministry, purged from the high echelons of the military, purged from the upper echelons of scientific research. We've seen it in the 60s in communist Poland, where men who were of Jewish extraction, who had been disciples and cohorts of Gromulka of the Communist Party in Poland for 30 years and more, were one by one purged from office, and many of them forced out of Poland and into exile. For the fact of the international socialist revolution is that it never succeeded in becoming international. Socialism, like most of the phenomenon of the modern world, stopped at various national boundaries. There was a Russian communist revolution. There was a communist party of Poland, of Hungary, of other countries of the world. And these communist parties retained many of the attitudes, the prejudices of the national group from which they sprung. And those very bourgeois poisons, maladies like anti-Semitism, which the ideologues of the Communist Party in the early years had been so quick to attack, proved to be ineradicable, proved to be catered to by these various socialist national groupings. And very often in Europe, we saw the very sad case of people of Jewish extraction who had been drawn to this party, these parties, by the hope of emancipation, the hope of throwing aside finally the label which marked them off, being even in the International Party singled out and marked off and purged. And again we have seen in the last 60 or 70 years all the old familiar apparatus of anti-Semitism operating in these groups. Often it was the Jew and the Jew alone who continued to speak with this kind of internationalist hope, for he held on to it most desperately. There was a jingle about this kind of Jew. Appeared in the 1930s, but it was true in the 1900s, it's true today. A steady patriot of the world alone, the friend of every country but his own. Now, it was all right for a Stalin or a Lenin to be a friend of Russia. It was all right for a Mao or Chou En-lai to be a friend of China, for a Castro, for a Che to be a friend of Cuba. But the Jews somehow found that they could not be friends with, close up to, their own people. And many of these Jews who made the road into the socialist camp were among those who turned most viciously and most bitterly against the Jews who had been left behind and attacked them with all the old familiar canards of the anti-Semitic literature. When Rosa Luxemburg, one of the leaders of the German socialist parties in the 1920s, tens, was in jail, a Jewish friend of hers addressed her and asked her why she didn't speak out against some of the atrocities that were being committed against the Jews in Eastern Europe. And she wrote an answer: "Why do you come to me with your special Jewish sorrows? I feel just as sorry about the wretched Indians or Negroes. I cannot find a special corner of my heart for the ghetto." Now, Stalin found a special corner of his heart for Russia, Mao for China, Castro for Cuba. But somehow these Jews could not find a special corner of their heart for their fellow Jew, who was still impoverished, still oppressed, still abused. This was in the 1900s, when the mass of the Jews of Eastern Europe were groaning under the indignities of anti-Semitism, the indignities of poverty. But she had no special corner of her heart for their sorrows. And we've seen in the 1960s, among some of our own young people of Jewish extraction who were in this country attracted to the radical movements, the same kind of special unconcern, special hate, if you will, for their own people of origin. When this young man, Jerry Rubin, during the height of his notoriety during the trial of the Chicago 7, was invited to the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati to speak, the students were eager to see such a person. He spoke at great length about the rights of the Palestinian peoples. He spoke not a word in his prepared address, apparently, about Israel and her rights to peace and survival. And some of the students pressed him at this point. And finally, he turned to them in disgust, and he said, with a very ugly gesture, simply, "Up the El Fatah." There were any number of young Jews who were willing to attack Israel, because Israel to them came to represent American imperialism. They used all the rhetoric of the Third World, which is largely an Arab anti-Israel world politically, to attack Israel for being worse than the Nazis in their treatment of the Arabs in the conquered territories. Not a word of understanding, not a word of solidarity with the very real socialist experiments going on in Israel. One of the most long-lived socialist experiments, the kibbutz, that the world has yet seen. But at the same time that the major stream of those who were attracted to radicalism among the Jewish community, it went out, it left behind, it departed. There were always those who moved into the radical camp and found some kind of way of connecting, of marrying up their radicalism and their Jewishness. And this isn't simply a modern phenomenon. I don't know if you know the name of Moses Hess. Moses Hess lived during the middle of the 19th century. He was a German Jew born in Bonn, born of a relatively middle-class Jewish family. He was a rebel. He was a college dropout. He went to live in a pad in Paris to be among the street people. And he was so much determined to put behind himself all the uptightness of the middle class, all that the establishment represented, that he married one of the street people, a prostitute, and much to the chagrin of his parents and all others, lived happily with her ever after. He was a member of the socialist camp who was condemned to death by the German government in 1848 for his part in the revolution. He co-authored with Marx and Engels two of the early pamphlets of the Communist Party. He was socially and in terms of lifestyle and in terms of politics a radical. But he broke with Marx at one point. And Marx spends a good deal of time in the Communist Manifesto attacking Moses Hess. He broke with him on the idea of the international. He said that men cannot simply put behind him the inherited traditions of country, of language, of manner, of nation, that each nation can in parallel have its own political and social revolution, that the Jewish people, the Jewish nation as he called them, has a particular talent for matters of social concern, and if the Jewish nation will remain concerned around its national identity, create a land in which they can work out their destiny, Israel, then we will. This nation can be a living example to the world of a truly revolutionary social experiment. And out of his communism and his residual Jewish interest, his interest in the Jew as a social experiment, Jewish nation as a social experiment, he penned in 1863 the first textbook of the Zionist movement, Rome and Jerusalem, in which he urged the establishment of a Jewish state in order that it might be a light to the nations, a light to the radical nations, a light to the revolution, as to how the revolution might in fact work itself out. I give you a man whose name you also may not know, but whose name is increasingly familiar to the young people on the college campuses. The name is Ber Borachov. This young Russian Jew was born in 1881. He died at the age of 36. He came from an intensely Jewish family in a little community in South Russia where the Tsar used to ship political prisoners. He was raised among these political prisoners. He was raised in Marxist ideology, and he was a convinced Marxist ideologue. But he broke with the Russian Communist Party when he found that these prisoners among whom he lived and worked were eager to have him come over to Russian internationalism, but that when he spoke to them of being a Jew, of his interest in doing something for the Jewish nation of Eastern Europe, they essentially read him out of their interests. Zionism and all these interests were recidivists, were revisionist. They had no place in the Russian dream. So Ber Borachov, with a man named Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, who became the first president of the State of Israel, wrote in 1906 the Constitution of the Pohelei Tzion, the International Labor Zionist Party, and Ber Borachov became, to a large degree, its ideologue. And his basic assumption, his basic insistence, was that there was nothing inconsistent between particularism, the nation, and internationalism, the radical revolution. And as a matter of fact, if the governments, if the peoples who were interested in the revolution continue to live as if the old traditions had no power, as if nations were not distinct entities, they were making a fundamental political fallacy of analysis, one which would come back to haunt them. And as a matter of fact, the history of the various socialist revolutions has been one which proved Borachov out. There has been no international communist party of any true significance, but within each nation, there have been effective socialist parties who have moved insofar as they could, who have moved their nation towards this kind of experimentation or revolution. Most of the leaders of Israel during the 1940s and 50s were young people who were radicals in every sense of the word, whose economic and political analysis were socialistic, and who had come to this Jewishness, to their Zionism, because they had been rebuffed and repulsed by the nationalist, communist, and socialist parties of Europe. Ben Zvi, Ben Gurion, all of these men were ideologues of the socialist community, who found that the socialist camp was not truly an internationalist camp. And so they determined to work out their socialist idealism within the reconstituted Jewish nation. And similarly, in the United States in the 1960s, as we saw another one of these periodic movements of young people of Jewish extraction who are attracted to the left and to radical analysis, we found both of these traditional responses to the radical appeal. On the one hand, there were any number of young Jews who were willing to mouth all of the criticism, all of the venom of the Third World and the New Left. If the more militant black community attacked the Israel and covertly used the words which are familiar to us from the anti-Semitic liturgy, they repeated these. Israel was an outpost of the American Empire. Israel was an aggressive nation who had taken onto themselves all of the patterns of the Hitlerian past. Israel was contemptuous of the rights of the free Palestinian people. Israel was belligerent and militaristic, and on and on and on. And they were contemptuous of their parents, of the Jews' home. We were somehow the establishment. Jews, they accepted the idea that Jews controlled the media, the Jews controlled the banks, that they were the only slumlords, they were the only people who dealt with the black community. They were somehow the guilty. Many a home was rent with the anger of these young people expressing itself in contempt for all that they had left behind. On the other hand, there were a small number of these young Jewish radicals to whom Judaism proved to be an interesting commodity. They found that they were repulsed by many on the New Left. The black said to the white, go home. The white said to the Jew, do your own thing. And the Jews who were radicals found that somehow they had to have a thing. And so there were groups of young Jewish radicals and some not so young Jewish radicals who began to say not that if black is beautiful, by which we mean we can claim soul, we can claim a kind of moral superiority, and that is our thing, we can claim Torah. Torah is our thing. It is somehow the source of our action, the source of our anger, the source of our idealism. And we found young people who were organizing what they called freedom seders around the country. Now, the seder proclaims freedom, and the Haggadah has always had in it a time in which Jews were encouraged to think not only of the needs of the Jews of the Soviet for freedom from Soviet oppression, the Jews of Israel for need from freedom from those who would destroy them, but the need of all peoples, the poor and the outcast, the minorities, whoever they are, to join in the great freedom, which is the need of all men. But these freedom seders were organized not as an exposure to Sinai and the Exodus, to the events in the past within a particular Jewish context. These freedom seders were organized to be issues, to be moments of political propaganda. The first of these seders was held in Washington 4 years ago. The invitation was publicly addressed by a group which calls itself the Jews for Urban Justice to, by name, every person in the Jewish community they could find who owned property in what they called the ghetto areas, and to every Jew who owned a store in or near these areas. No invitations were addressed by the organized committee of blacks and radical Jews to whites who were not Jews who happened to own land or buildings or stores in the area, or to blacks who owned land or building or stores in this area. But by name, these Jews were listed, and the Haggadah, which was used, was rewritten so that it expressed for these young people all their anger against the injustice being done in Washington, in the black community, and it had no longer any kind of concern with the injustice being done to Jews in Washington and out of Washington, wherever it be throughout the world. They were citizens of the whole world alone, friends of every country but their own. Now, sometimes the use of propaganda, of Jewish symbols for propaganda by these political activists is rather fascinating. Sometimes it's rather ingenious. A young man, a man who can't find peace with himself, who was a rabbi, who became the assistant chaplain at Columbia University and has since been dismissed from that post, organized several years ago an evening to exorcise the Dibuk, which he said, the evil spirit, which he said had taken hold of the heart of Judge Hoffman, who was presiding judge at the trial of the Chicago Seven. Now, we laugh at moments such as this, but they're effective uses of ritual for cathartic and propagandist purposes. But unfortunately, they are arrogant. And that's the very definition of propaganda. The same group in Washington, the Jews for Urban Justice, were asked by a congregation which was filled with guilt that somehow these young people were saying, no one listens to me, no one pays attention to me, I'm being driven off because you are self-righteous, to organize for those who wished within the congregation on Kol Nidre night a special Yom Kippur service. This was 2 years ago. And they wrote for Kol Nidre a special alchet, a special confession. I'd like to read to you part of it. For the sin which we have committed before thee by violence, by paying soldiers to burn Vietnamese babies alive without forcing our rulers to stop the war machine, by sending 40,000 of our sons to be killed in the legal war without forcing our rulers to stop the war machine, by using chemical products that poison the air and give people cancer, ourselves and our families included, without forcing our rulers to change these products, by using machines for transportation that are so built that they club, slash, and mutilate people, ourselves and our families included, without forcing our rulers to change these machines, by creating and using a medical system that condemns black babies to die at twice the rate of white and Jewish babies, without forcing our rulers to change the medical system, by creating, owning, and supporting a system of grocery stores that starves some children to apathy and death while we and our children get fat, without forcing our rulers to feed all children free, by paying and applauding policemen who gas shoot and beat black people and our own children, without forcing our rulers to place the police under the control of the people they police, by keeping black people out of our neighborhoods and not keeping rats out of the black neighborhoods, so black children are bitten to death by rats, without forcing our rulers to end the existence of the slums. For all these sins, O God of forgiveness. Now, all these sins are sins, ugly, vicious, perhaps overstated, but nonetheless real. But what is utterly missing in this confession, in this vidui, is any sense of my sin. These are the sins of others, the sins of the establishment, the sins of the government, the sins of the military-industrial complex, the sins of the rich. But the very genius of Yom Kippur is that it not only names our sins, but other sins, but our own sins. For the sins which we have sinned against thee, O God, by speaking disrespectfully of parents and teachers, by breaking homes, by breaking the bonds of family, because we were contemptuous, we spit out ugliness at our parents. For the sins which we have sinned against thee, O Lord, by putting into our bodies all kinds of drugs of poison, by having no sense of the dignity of our own person, of the purity of the body which you gave us. For all these sins, O God, of forgiveness. For the violence we have committed against thee, O God, by shouting epithets and arrogant lies against, overstated lies against others who simply are trying to do their job. for all these sins, O God of forgiveness. None of this, but only the sins of others. And that is propaganda and not a confession. Now, there have been among those on the radical left a number of young groups who have not tried to use the religious tradition as propaganda, because its rituals are effective, because they need a series of rituals, even as the black have their series of rituals, and these permit a tie between radical groups, which they would otherwise, in this pluralistic radicalism, not have. But these young people begin where these young people are not willing to go, and that is in a radical identification with the Jewish people. That's ultimately what marks off the Jew from the Jew who is leaving or the Jew who is left. Will he identify himself with the community? In over 50 campuses in the nation today, there are what are called radical Zionist alliances. These are groups of young people, small percentage of the numbers in the campus, who insist on a radical economic and political analysis of the sins of the nation and the sins of other nations, but who insist on the legitimacy of Israel, who see Israel for what it is, a socialist country trying to live with power and with idealism, with challenge and trying to respond humanely to its problems, who are unscathing at times in their criticism of Israel for its mistreatment of the Oriental Jew or of the poor Jew, who demand a reordering of national priorities for Israel as for this nation, but whose fundamental principle begins and ends with the legitimate right of the Jew to live as a Jew. And these young people have today some 20 or 25 college newspapers. They're a very active group on this campus. They have not had to sacrifice any of their political concerns or urgencies, but being Jewish, the Jewish nation, the Jewish people, has given them the focus in which they can express much of what they feel. Now, what's the moral of this whole story? The moral, I think, is simply this. Judaism is not a political ideology. The first law after the law of belief is the law, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven images, nor any manner of likeness, the law against idolatry. Man will never know the ultimate truth. All that we can do is to use our mind and our heart to respond intelligently and wisely to what we think and believe to be the urgencies and the necessities of the day. There will be good Jews open to the Word of God, open to the tradition, who read that tradition in a radical sense. And there will be good Jews who are open to the tradition, who read that tradition in a less radical sense. Now, no Jew can be open to that tradition and listen to the voice of God and not be concerned with his fellow human being, and not be concerned with the injustices of the society. But it's a matter of strategy, of tactics, of approach, not a matter of concern. But when one ceases to be a Jew, one imposes the voices of the world without on the voice that wells up from within. We no longer are able to say, Adonai hu ha-Elohim, the Lord, he is God. When they organize a freedom seder, when they organize this kind of confessional for Yom Kippur, they're not listening to the voice of God, which demands humility as well as action, silence as well as words. They're listening to the voices which they hear all about them every day, which insist that there's a particular kind of economic and political philosophy which alone is true. And when we listen to the voice which wells up from our own tradition, we must listen to it as Jews. All of us, radical and non-radical. All of us in the last century have found our lives disturbed by a pathetic desire to belong, to be quit of the hate of others. It has never been easy to be a Jew. And so we have been desperately eager to hear the words of brotherhood, the words of ecumenicity, the words of acceptance, the words of international promise. But the words have not always been meant. We have neglected the particularity, the distinctiveness of various national traditions, including our own. So eager to be accepted by the outside world, we have taken certain blandishments at face value. Dress like us and we'll accept you. Have manners like us, worship like we do, and you'll be welcome in our society. Restrain your own political concerns and vote the way we do, and then you'll be welcome in our clubs and in our community. Or shout the words of revolution as we do, and we'll welcome you into our revolution. Lo zu haderech. This has never been the way. Jews right and left and center have tried to make themselves into non-Jews in order to be accepted by the larger world, have found that the larger world continues to see them as Jews. Leon Trotsky was among the great founders of the Russian Revolution. Among his crimes was being a Jew. You cannot escape this background. You may as well make the best of it. And there are great things to be found in it. What's the moral of the story? To live our lives for as what we are, according to the light, and the urgencies, and the principles which are ours. Not to look behind the shoulder, not to try or make ourselves other into something other, but to accept our responsibilities to our own and to our world, and to live with a judgment which is unclouded by a desperate need to belong. We belong to God, and that ought to be enough. Amen.